Good morning and welcome to Holden Village. Today is Tuesday, July 23rd, and in the fireside room, Fred Strickert continues his series, or it's starting a new series this week, sorry, Luke's Fascination with 40, and this session is entitled The Last Temptation, Jesus' Last 40 Hours. So let's go and join Fred now for this morning's Bible study.
Now we can start the tape rolling. I'm Fred Strickert, and I'm doing the Bible studies for this two-week period in the middle of July on Luke's Gospel and trying to make connections to the wilderness experience. And yesterday we talked about the journey to Jerusalem as, in a way, looking back as a journey Israelites made for 40 days in the wilderness, and they looked at their priorities and were satisfied along the way. You know, they had few possessions, and it looks ahead to the church and the Lenten season as we reevaluate what's important in our lives. Today, we're moving on to the Passion of Jesus. And probably going to be looking at it in a different way than any of you have ever looked at it before. I say that because I've never looked at it before. And sometimes when you have a series like this, it brings kind of new eyes and to something, a new perspective. And so I'm going to be highlighting just certain parts of the Passion story. Basically, Luke chapter 22 and 23. And so if you have Bibles, that'll be the main focus, chapter 2 and 23 of Luke. And I'm planning to use on the screen a whole series of transparencies that will have the gospel set out in parallel columns. And this is a way that I, and by the way, there are plenty of Bibles over here. People need them. A number of different translations. Most of them are new NRSV, I believe. What I have up here is actually the old RSV, which they didn't call it old RSV. But it was just RSV, of course. But all the way back in my seminary days, this is how I learned to really study the Gospels by putting them side by side, and that way you can see what is unique about a given writer and what is their perspective. Because there's a lot of similarities, but every once in a while there's a word that's different, or a phrase that's different, or even sometimes a block of material that's different. And we're going to be focusing on Luke in that particular way today. So the thing that I had yesterday, for example, was I think I passed out the synopsis that I had typed up. It was new RSV. They haven't published one yet, even though the new RSV has been out for a good decade or so. So this is RSV, and if you have new RSV and you notice something, feel free to bring it up. And all the way through, I encourage you to raise questions, give your observations all the way through. Don't feel like we have to stop and be asked for questions. I don't want to hear what some of you have to say. To start with, let me talk about the Passion, but I gave a title to this session as Jesus' Last 40 Hours, The Last Temptation, and the 40 hours is totally inserted by me. Nobody knows, you know, the time frame here, but I want to look at the Passion as a revisiting of the temptation story. Please.
The handout that we have is Jesus Rebukes the Wilderness.
Right. Yeah, I have all, we're going to look at it. I don't have a handout for all of you today. I don't have a handout on this particular topic, but that was something we did on Friday. And I think it might be helpful just to look at it. I had enough copies that were left over, and so we are going to kind of refer to that too.
Okay.
So that, for a few of you, the few of you who were here last week, we may have about a 5-minute repetition. And in the early part of last week, we looked at the temptation story. And one of the fascinating things for me, I mean, when you look at it at the very beginning, it's obviously connected with the wilderness wanderings of Israel. 40 years becomes 40 days, but it's in the wilderness. And what's of course significant is that the term wilderness is in Greek the same word that's used to translate, I mean, in the Greek version of the Old Testament, the wilderness area for Israel, which was probably down the Sinai. It's the same Greek term that's used for the Judean wilderness. And it'll be used all throughout the gospel on that sheet that I passed out. Sometimes it's translated as the desert, sometimes as the wilderness, sometimes as a deserted place, sometimes as a lonely place. But it's the same word. And when you use the same word, it seems like sometimes you might be wanting to make a connection between a number of different places here. And in this particular episode, the temptations, basically only Matthew and Luke have the three temptations. Mark, that's why when you print it out this way, immediately you see all this blank space. And you don't always realize this with the Gospel of Mark has a very short version without the three temptations. Just Jesus was tempted by Satan 40 days in the wilderness, and he was with the wild beast, and that's it. And that's always an interesting thing, because we read the temptation story first Sunday of Lent every year, and it rotates.
Yeah.
And the year that it gets to be Mark, we read it, and it's almost like, oh boy, I missed something. It's so short, you know? And we, in our minds, we can't help but read in these three temptations in here. I mean, you hear this, and we've heard it so often that it all comes together in our minds, and sometimes we don't think of the distinct stories. But what I just want to pick up on two big points here, and well, one more preliminary point about Luke. There are three temptations, and each temptation Jesus comes back to Satan with a quotation. And all three of those quotations come from one section of the Old Testament, Deuteronomy 6 to 8, which is the time when Moses is reflecting with the Israelites about that wilderness experience and talking about, did you have enough to eat in the wilderness? And what were these other ways in which you were tested in the wilderness? So there's no question that story is linked back to the wilderness experience of Israel. Now, what is unique about Luke, there are basically two points that I want to make here at the beginning, and then we'll be referring to those when we jump ahead to 22. But one is that the order of the events is different between Luke and Matthew. And I think this might be significant. I'm going to emphasize the word might. The difference of the three temptations. Both of them start off with stones to bread. The temptation. Look at these stones. Jesus is hungry. Look at these stones. Turn them to bread. And then Jesus quotes, one shall not live by bread alone. I have to apologize. I'm going to keep leaning in front of you here. So we move this back. Any good time?
Yes.
We need
much better.
This better? Okay.
Yes. Yeah.
Thank you for the point. Okay, and then the second one, I've got to put it up there straight now. Okay. The second one then, in Matthew's version, is Jesus is at a high place and throw yourself down. And it's, you shall not tempt the Lord your God. In Luke's version, it said the second one is taken up to a high place and shown all the kingdoms of the world, and I will give you all of this authority. So the focus on showing, can Jesus receive the kingdoms in just an instant? Is there a shortcut to the kingdom? Is there a shortcut? And of course, in the gospel, is there a shortcut to the reign of God? Or what really is the reign of God? Is the reign of God different from the kingdoms of the world? This is kingdoms of the world. But all that is in this particular temptation. So that's the second one. And then the last one here is the throw yourself down. And this is really interesting because here Satan quotes the Old Testament. Jesus isn't the only person who quotes the Old Testament. We start playing the game of who can quote the most Bible passages to win the argument thing. And Satan says, well, okay, you're doing all this Deuteronomy stuff, but let's pick up Psalm 91. And in Psalm 91, it talks about God giving the angels charge over us, and the angels look after us and will guard us. And one of the interesting things I notice about that is in the Psalms, it's, and the angels will guard and protect us on our paths. And that's something that Satan quoted the Old Testament but left out those three important words, the on the paths kind of thing, which is, okay, you know, the angels are with us, you know, as we are going on the way, but it's, you know, it's not a carte blanche kind of thing. I mean, here out in the wilderness, a good way of describing it, I mean, you know, it's safe to go out, and we need to test ourselves and make the hike to Holden Lake or wherever, and on the paths, but, you know, if I leave the paths, it's risky business, and, you know, who knows what's going to happen here. And if, you know, if I really, you know, am tempting the wilderness in such a way as saying, I go anywhere and it's not going to matter, that's, you know, that's getting into dangerous territory. And there may be something there with Satan leaving that out, discovering, you know, what is the path to follow. Maybe part of this, and that's what the temptation is all about. And of course, then Jesus comes back with him. Don't tempt the Lord your God. But it's the throw yourself down from here. And so the order, now think about this, because we're going to come back to this at the very end today. The order is stones to bread, kingdoms of the world, and then throw yourself down from here. Let's see what happens. Will the angels take charge of you? So that's one thing. The order is unique. And then, if you notice here, Matthew's gospel just ends, then the devil left him. And that's a very, very simple ending. And Luke's version, it's, and when the devil had ended every temptation, he departed from him. But it's the until. This is the key word here. The devil departed until an opportune time. And the root of that is the word kairos, that opportune moment, that moment of decision. And that's our entree into the episode for today. Yeah, okay. It's just kind of background. In chapter 22, we start off, we don't know exactly when it is. The Passover is drawing near. And for Luke, the Passover begins Thursday night. So we know it's after Sunday when we have the Palm Sunday entry into Jerusalem. And sometime there in the week. And so for my purposes, I have to calculate it back. It's got to be 40 hours before 3 o'clock on Friday afternoon. Because we have to do the 40 and the 40. Okay. That's, don't take me seriously on that. But just to draw the parallel. But what's happening, somewhere there on Wednesday, or maybe it was Thursday, or maybe it was Tuesday, those days, very close to the end of Jesus' life, the chief priests and scribes are gathering together, seeking how to put him to death. And the concern is they feared the people. So they got to do something about Jesus. The very next verse, this is the key one here. Then Satan entered into Judas. And so that's that's obviously the link back to the temptation story. Satan departs from Jesus for a time, for the opportune time. And now he's coming back. So this is the beginning of the last temptation. What's going to be happening in the rest of the Passion story. Okay? Everybody with me? what we're doing so far. And then, and I got to keep moving up here, but I hope this doesn't bother you. Okay. And so, enter Judas into the scene, and Judas comes, and they start having a discussion how it is they might betray him. And the interesting thing is, it comes to a money thing, a money exchange, which is rather interesting, especially if, for those of you who were here yesterday, where has Judas been all along? And Jesus talking about possessions on the journey to Jerusalem and giving away what you have. And instead, he's there. What he has learned from all this is, you know, how can you get more? And that's part of the betrayal here. But he agrees, and he saw an opportunity. And that comes right out of the Mark. It's nothing new, but that is exactly the same word that was in the temptation story, where, and Satan left Jesus for the opportune time. And so again, the way this is worded here, this is the opportune time. Now what we have, where Luke added onto Mark, is to betray him in the absence of the multitude. The idea is to find Jesus alone. And being alone is normally meaning being vulnerable. And that's part of the temptation story at the beginning of the gospel. Jesus is alone in the wilderness for 40 days and 40 nights. And you have the whole vulnerability there. And that's when Satan comes. But since that first temptation, what we find in Luke's gospel is being alone is really a place for prayer, for renewal, for strengthening. What Luke shows us is that Jesus is going to be presenting the model of the wilderness as being an opportunity to strengthen oneself rather than the idea of being vulnerable. And in contrast, the absence of the multitudes, the crowds are always the place of proclamation, of teaching and healing. We get that theme all the way through Luke. Now this is where I think maybe what we'll do is go back and we'll look at the sheet. I have a sheet passed out here which says Jesus retreats to the wilderness. And this was what I did last Friday. So apologies for those of you who were here Friday. We'll do this. I'm just going to run through this real quickly. But last Friday, we talked about Jesus up in Galilee. That period of time, 1 to 3 years, where Jesus has his Galilean ministry. And what is fascinating about that, I mean, you always have the focus on the crowds. And Jesus is always proclaiming. People are just coming, wanting to be healed and hearing the message, receiving teaching. And that's always up there in the forefront during Jesus' Galilean ministry. And we have the popularity there. And what Luke does, and it's actually all the Gospels have a little bit here, but what Luke does is really emphasize that it's Jesus is constantly going back and forth between the crowds and that active ministry and retreating to the wilderness to be spoken. So the very first day, out of the context of the upper left-hand column on this thing, it talks about really kind of the first day in the life of Jesus. And he goes to the synagogue, and there's discussions. Something happens, a healing, or something happens, and there's a discussion about that, a controversy. And then you have the episode of Jesus goes to Peter's mother-in-law's house for lunch, and she happens to have a fever, and so there's another healing. And by now, the word has gotten out, and the crowds come. And when the sun goes down on that Sabbath, all of a sudden they go outside, and they find crowds of people there coming for healing. They wouldn't break the Sabbath, but at the evening time, they bring the people to be healed by Jesus. And so he's busy that evening, and so this brings us to the first episode that I have on this sheet. That Mark's version, in the morning, while it's still very dark, Jesus gets up and goes out to a deserted place. And again, it's the same word as the wilderness term here. The same term is used there as an adjective there. he goes out to a deserted place, and there he prays. So very early, when he's faced with all this work to do, he goes out and he allows himself to be filled. Okay? And it's interesting, Matthew omitted that part. But Luke, of course, continues on with that. He departed and went to the deserted place, and it talks about the crowds looking for him. And, you know, Jesus is, it seems like, you know, every step along the way, okay, he's reflecting, taking that time to reflect, okay, what's next? You know, what is my ministry? Am I to be the, you know, the in-residence provider for the people in Capernaum, or am I to go elsewhere? And so as he moves out, first he takes that time of reflection. So being alone is a very positive kind of thing. He goes out and he expands his ministry to all the towns and villages of Galilee. And so you have that, and you have the story of the miraculous catch of fish, and you have Peter following Jesus, and the cleansing of the leper. And then Luke 5:15, now more than ever the word about Jesus spread abroad. Many crowds would gather to hear him and be cured. That whole purpose of being with the crowds. And then 16, but he would withdraw to deserted places to pray. And notice that it's plural. It became the pattern in Jesus. You know, not just one time taking off, but he would be very active in preaching and healing, but always taking the time out to retreat to the wilderness, to have that time alone. And that would fill him. And we go on. I think I'll skip those on the top of the page. But then we get to the middle of the flip side here. Critical moments occur. Jesus naming the 12 disciples. And in Mark's, well, if you look there in Matthew's version, it's a little bit in the middle of the page, about three down here. Matthew chapter 10, verse 1. Matthew introduces that very simply. And then Jesus summoned the 12 disciples. And then you get the names of the 12. Mark has a little bit more. He went up the mountain and called to them those he wanted. And they came to him. And then he names the 12. But notice what Luke has. And during those days, he went out to the mountain to pray and spent the entire night in prayer. And then when day came, he called his disciples and chose 12 of them, and then you get the names. So every critical moment in Jesus' life, you begin with a retreat to the wilderness. So the retreat to the wilderness is not vulnerability here. He's with God, and he's filled, and this is a strengthening kind of time for him, the way it's portrayed here in Luke's gospel. And now, you'll notice here, they don't use the word wilderness here in Luke 6. It's to the mountain. And I guess for us here at Holden, that's real easy. I mean, this is wilderness, this is mountain. And it's a little bit different from there are hills and the Judean wilderness and the desert kind of thing too. But it's, mountains can be very significant with the prayer. And then you have the feeding of the 5,000, the same kind of thing, where Jesus is distressed over the reports about John the Baptist and retreats again to the wilderness, and the crowds are coming, and he feeds them again, so there's sufficiency in the wilderness. If you flip over to the last page, I'm just running through this quickly, because we're going to get back to 22 here, but this is all background here. The confession of Simon Peter, which is a critical part in the gospel. You know, it's halfway through Mark's gospel. Jesus is with the disciples, and this is where Jesus says, who do people say that I am? And then he starts saying, John the Baptist, or one of the prophets. And then he says, who do you say that I am? And that's what Peter says, you are the Christ. You know, it's a critical point in the gospel. And notice the way Mark has it. Jesus went on with his disciples to the villages of Caesarea Philippi. It's on the way, then that's having the conversation. So they're kind of on the road. But notice Luke. Once when Jesus was praying alone, the disciples were with him, he asked them. So again, it's that praying, and you kind of see the kind of concern for the disciples here in this kind of situation. So again, it's the being alone and the praying part. And that gets ready for that confession. Same thing with the Transfiguration episode. All of the the text, of course, have the part about the mountain, going up the mountain, because that's the place of transfiguration is a high mountain apart. But in notice in Luke's gospel, four lines down, you have the addition of the he went to the mountain to pray. The mountain's a place for prayer and strengthening. And it's mentioned the second time, and while he was praying. So when you have the Galilean ministry, I hope the theme that you see, it's Jesus is very actively involved in proclaiming and teaching and healing. But you have this pattern of constant retreat to the wilderness to be refreshed and then to come back in more and more. And the last thing on that page you notice is the Lord's Prayer. And it's interesting how Luke introduces the Lord's Prayer different from Matthew. Well, Matthew, it's in the Sermon on the Mount, and the mountain is a formal kind of a presentation. And, you know, chapter 5 is the Beatitudes, and then chapter 6 is, well, what are the general signs of piety? And you have prayer, alms, fasting, whole discussion. You know, it's a nice little lecture that Jesus has lined up here, and part of that is the Lord's Prayer. But in Luke's Gospel, it's, once again, Jesus is out there praying, and the disciples are saying, you know, we've been watching you, and you're always going out there and praying. And can you give us a little bit of advice on that? Give us a little structure. What, you know, what can we actually say? So it's that you know, if you want to call that a teachable moment, where instead of Jesus saying, okay, this is what you pray, it's this is what Jesus does. And then the disciples ask the question, and then Jesus teaches the Lord's Prayer there. Okay. So you get the pattern. When you see Jesus being alone, the opportunity in the absence of the multitude, that's not necessarily a bad thing. I mean, at the beginning of the gospel, there, you know, it emphasized the vulnerability in the wilderness. But what we see is Jesus using those opportunities of being alone in a very positive kind of thing. And once again, you have to ask, you know, Judas, did you miss all that? Did you miss all those times Jesus retreated in the wilderness? You know, where were you? You know, you weren't very observant there. What follows then, Judas has made the decision, and that I didn't print out, but the very next section, of course, is the Last Supper. And so Jesus provides the bread. And of course, it's a Passover meal. And, you know, tying us back to the time of the wilderness and, you know, providing for them the bread they need for the journey ahead in the next hours and so forth. And as soon as that's over then, let's see, let's move this up to the top of the page. Keep moving here. Then we have Jesus and the disciples going to Gethsemane. Mark's gospel, and they went to a place which is called Gethsemane. And when they get there, Jesus says to the disciples, sit here while I pray. And then he takes Peter, James, and John. He's greatly distressed. And then Jesus prays, falls on the ground. Okay, that's the story we're very familiar with. As you're looking at Luke, what do you notice that's different here?
Less detail where we typically see.
Yeah, I see lots of words here. Luke kind of streamlines the story.
It's not as compassionate.
The what?
It's not as compassionate.
In
Luke.
In terms of what kind of things
the
do you not see?
The distress, that he was distressed, he was sorrowful.
The part, yeah, the part that's omitted is all the distress of Jesus and the sorrow. And we even get, you know, falling on the ground becomes kneeling on the ground, where it sounds like more control and... I mean, building up these spiritual exercises over the years, it's the natural kind of thing to do. And so it's maybe that posture thing is emphasized. But yeah, but this is what's omitted, the whole focus on the distress part here. Okay, anything else people see? Please.
This is the first time he's been to Gethsemane, because it says this was his custom.
Okay. And he came out and went, as was his custom, to where did you say he went?
Well, to the Mount of Olives.
That's kind of interesting. It doesn't mention Gethsemane. It's just the Mount of Olives. Matthew and Mark say Gethsemane. And here he says Mount of Olives. Now, I don't know, those of you who have visited Jerusalem, it's the same. And, I mean, Mount of Olives is eastern side of the old city. Mount of Olives goes up, and of course, it's called the Mount of Olives. There's a lot of olive trees going there, although you get olive trees on almost every mountain there. But this one particularly, and Gethsemane's, the name is somehow connected with the olive press or something, so it's, you know, one finger part of the Mount of Olives. But why would you have the focus on Mount of Olives rather than saying Gethsemane? Why would you say that? Have you picked up on what we've been going through? What happens on mountains?
The mountains are the prayer.
Mountains are places for prayer for Jesus. So it's, you know, just like all the way through Galilee, when Jesus would retreat, retreat in the wilderness, retreat in the mountain, were kind of the same kind of thing.
You know those little hills that you're talking about?
No, those are mountains. Yeah. Let's compare Holy Village, the Judean hillside. Yeah. And so, and by using the expression mountain, is, you know, maybe more symbolic.
Sure, and it's not like he got in his car to go to the desert, you know. He probably went three blocks away or something. Unless he ran, unless he was.
Yeah, I mean, it's close by. Yeah, and I mean, in a way, you know, a deserted place then doesn't necessarily have to be a geographical kind of thing,
right.
any place.
Right.
So we can have our own places of wilderness for strengthening that are, you know, in the city, in our own house. And that, you know.
Bill. The thing that's very clear here that I've really never noticed before is the spiritual discipline of Jesus.
Mm-hmm.
And the habits that results in a godly life.
Mm-hmm. And that's, I mean, that's what, number one, strengthens Jesus, mm-hmm. but number two, teaches others the way of spiritual discipline. And you have the disciples, you know, learning and the people learning that. But that's very clear here. And, I mean, I think the emphasis on, I mean, mentioning Mount of Olives may be a way of, you know, once again, we say, as was his custom, not just going to Mount of Olives, but other places of wilderness, sometimes other hillsides or other places alone. That was his custom. So it's even referring all the way back to the beginning. But here in Jerusalem, I mean, actually, what chapters come before, Jesus spends his time in the city and then goes out and stays there at night. And, you know, it's not just that the cheaper motels are, you know, out in the suburbs, but it's, you can be alone and have that strengthening so that he goes back in the daytime and proclamation. Go ahead, Bill.
Yeah, in one of the accounts in the, kind of earlier you had on the screen, I don't think it was Luke, right after his baptism, it was something like, and the Spirit immediately drove him into the wilderness. Is there any sense that we get from Luke that there's that ongoing relationship with Spirit that calls him to the wilderness? Are we left to believe this is just the habits of a spiritual leader?
I don't recall it being specific up to now, where it refers to the Spirit as doing this. Actually, the wording that you mentioned is actually Mark's wording of after the baptism, the Spirit drove him. And the interesting thing is in Luke, it's, and Jesus full of the Holy Spirit. And that idea of full of the Holy Spirit is, seems to me as, I mean, that's being filled, that's going to continue on kind of thing. And I think in that way, but not all these specific little times looking at it. I look at it that way. Okay? But yeah, this, as was his custom, that's in there. This is the way Jesus has done things all the way back since Galilee, going off. And in Jerusalem, that whole week, he kept going out there at night. And so, we actually add another line that's not here, and the disciples follow. Here they go to Gethsemane, and he said his disciples are obviously there. But by saying that, notice how he's streamlined so many things. But to add that in there, maybe for the point of emphasis, as this again is the Jesus teaching, in the time of his distress and sorrow, Jesus is using this opportunity as a teaching moment for the disciples. And so they are following. And you know, Judas didn't pick up on that, but the other disciples, are they starting to learn? And so you get a contrast here. What Jesus does there in the Mount of Olives is he addresses the disciples, pray that you may not enter temptation, instead of sit here, passively sit here, wait while I pray. There's a big difference there. You know, there's a big difference. Now, the way it's spelled out in Mark's gospel, Jesus says, sit here while I pray. You have the distress. He goes out, he falls to the ground, and then the prayer, Abba, Father, you know, remove this cup from me. Sorry about the foot here. Let me jump in back here. Wait a minute. Okay. Next sheet, as far as following Mark, then Jesus comes back, finds them sleeping. He's given them the instructions. You know, sit here, wait. Why are you sleeping? Then it's when he says, pray that you may not enter temptation. And then he goes away a second time and he prays, comes back, finds them sleeping, and a third time. So it's the repetition in Mark's gospel is emphasizing, in a sense, the disciples are kind of bungling this moment. This is the key moment for Jesus. And they keep falling asleep, and he keeps reminding them. And it emphasizes their weakness there. So that's the way Mark tells the story. But what we saw in Luke's gospel, instead of sit here while I pray, at the very beginning, he says, you pray. After all, I've taught you all the way along. And there in chapter 11, you came and asked me, you know, how are we to pray, Jesus? And he teaches them the Lord's Prayer. And so he says, okay, here. You pray while I also am praying. And then you have Jesus pray. It's at the bottom of the previous page. It's the, you know, take the cup, the same prayer. And then at the end, he does see him sleeping, but you don't have the repetition of three times. But at the end, again, he repeats the pray that you may not enter into temptation. And it's not just here in the garden, but what's going to be following all along. And so it's, you know, by having this statement repeated twice at the beginning and at the end, it's now, disciples, what are you going to be learning from this? Well, I mean, Jesus is being strengthened, but disciples also need that.
It's also, another difference is Mark has the select few, the top three, yeah, four, and they have all of the disciples.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah. And that might be part of the streamline to really focus on this little sandwich. Okay.
Also seems though that Luke is more inclusive in his whole gospel. So by saying all the disciples are there, there's a like more folks are included.
Yeah.
Mark is more specific.
Yeah, when you get back to the whole, you know, how do the Gospels come into being? I mean, one of the interesting things, of course, is that Mark has often been described to be a friend of Peter, and that's, I mean, he's writing, and he's gotten it from Peter, and, you know, so you got that kind of connection. You quickly get that kind of connection in Mark.
Curious, in the Luke Gospel, he came to the disciples and found them sleeping for sorrow. In the others, it didn't give any kind of a reason. I guess I'm curious as to how you interpret the for sorrow. Were they so exhausted because they were so upset, or they felt that they'd have an escape in sleeping? And that's a little bit different than the others.
Yeah, that is. And what's interesting is Mark has, you know, Jesus is the one who feels sorrowful, and here it's they are. So, I mean, it almost is, actually, the way Luke is describing the disciples are presented in a better light, like they're understanding more of what happens. And what's interesting, I didn't realize this, but we're going to be turning to the arrest scene, and there's no emphasis on the disciples running away and deserting Jesus like Matthew and Mark have. He'll miss it. I didn't notice that before, but I mean, they're not there at the cross, but they seem to be a little bit more in tune than Mark and Matthew there, and so that might be they're more aware of what's going on here.
Excuse me, in my translation is NIV. It's exhausted from sorrow.
Mm, okay, yeah. But they're understanding a little bit about the dynamics of what's happening here. Okay, I keep moving along here. Let's see. That one we wait a minute. Okay. I just did this at 7:30. He's back in the wrong place. Then you get the arrest. When Jesus says, rise, pray that you not enter temptation, that's when Judas and the crowd show up. And what I found was kind of interesting here, I mean, obviously they all come, and here it's Judas came, one of the 12, and with him a crowd. Here it's, and there came a crowd, the man called Judas, one of the 12, was leading them. A couple, and saying the same thing, but two things. One, Judas leading. And interestingly, in the previous section, Jesus comes and the disciples are following. And Judas hasn't picked up that message on how to follow. You know, that, can we make a kind of connection there? The other is putting crowd before Judas is kind of interesting. I mean, usually you want to put something you want to be really thinking about there to begin. Instead of focusing on Judas and what's happening to him, let's put a little emphasis on the crowd here. And of course, this is back to what we were talking about before. Judas was supposed to find the opportune moment to get Jesus alone in the absence of the crowd. And here the irony. Jesus brings the crowd to Jesus. And when Jesus is with the crowd, what's he do? Proclamation and healing. And sure enough, that's the way it's described here, what's going to happen. I mean, you have the initial episode, the identification, the kiss here, and then, as the other Gospels, immediately you have someone taking out the sword and cutting off the ear of the slave of the high priest. And, okay, we have nothing here in Mark. But when we have it here with Luke, first of all, Jesus speaks, no more of this. This is not the way. This is not the way. Not the way of violence. Not the way of, you know, of power here. But then, something unique in this gospel, Jesus touches the ear and heals it. And it's only this gospel. Being with the crowds is dealing with their needs. And you see, I mean, the situation here is, you know, for all human beings at a time like this, it's, oh, look at me in this situation. And your whole being is concerned on yourself. And yet in this moment, Jesus is still other-directed. As it's always been. I mean, and the other-directed in terms of healing their needs. So only Luke has that. And then, to the crowds, including those who've come out to arrest him, then he gives a little bit of proclamation here about the contrast between teaching in the daytime and, you know, the power of the darkness kind of thing. So, because Judas turned this situation of being alone into a crowd situation, Jesus acts as he always does with the crowds, preaching and healing in that situation. And here, this is, you know, this is the part here where disciples then flee. And notice blank space here. The disciples are not depicted. You know, it's not emphasized that they are departing. Okay, the road. I'm just going to pick up a couple things real quick with the road to Golgotha. We talk about Jesus as being other-directed. The whole situation on the cross is Jesus seems to be continuing to teach from the cross. And he does that because there's crowds with him the whole way. And we Well, and part of that teaching is teaching on how to be other directed. And we saw that in Gethsemane with the healing. I skipped over the whole trial situation, but the one part that's always struck me about the trial is with Jesus in with Caiaphas, and Jesus confesses he is the Christ, and out in the courtyard you have Peter denying his connection with Jesus, denying that he is the cross or the Christ. And one small detail in Luke is that at that moment, the third time that Peter has denied Jesus, there's one added detail. Does anybody remember from readings? How does Jesus react the third time? You ever?
He looks.
And that's only Luke's gospel. He turns and he looks at Jesus. And it doesn't say what kind of look, but he kind of, a look of disappointment and maybe a look of contact and, don't you remember, Peter? Think about this, reflecting on what is happening here kind of thing. So it's that, even in that time, where Jesus, or normal people, they're all concerned about themselves, Jesus is still other-directed with Simon Peter. On the road to the cross, you have the Simon of Cyrene thing is the same. But then you have this whole section where there are multitudes with Jesus. He's not alone. The multitudes are following. And so Jesus, instead of being so concerned about himself, he's concerned about those who are following. Daughters of Jerusalem, don't weep for me, weep for yourselves and your children. The days are coming. And so again, being with the crowds is proclaiming. And even, it's interesting, all his wilderness experience, just reading through this, he gives some nice little illustrations of being out in the wilderness and maybe even at Holden, of crying to the mountains, and you have the landslides occurring, fall on us, and then a reference of when this is happening, when the wood is green, what's going to happen when it dries? And we look at the smoke and the fire. Jesus is in tune to what happens out in the wilderness there. But anyway, but it's the real focus is really the other directedness. Now we get to Golgotha, and we've already said that the crowds were with Jesus. And so, at that time, on the cross, Jesus is going to be teaching them. And the part I'm just going to focus on, we only have a few minutes here, but the words of Jesus from the cross. I want to pick up on this. There are seven words of Jesus from the cross. And I assume a lot of you have probably done Good Friday services where you have the seven words. Now, what's, of course, interesting is there's no gospel that has the seven words.
Right?
Matthew and Mark both share one word. That my God, why have you forsaken me? And Luke doesn't have it. We've already seen this, with omitting that kind of sorrow. This Luke doesn't capitalize on that moment of feeling forsaken. Jesus is using this as the opportunity to teach the crowds with him. So that's not part of Luke's gospel. So that word, that one word is in Matthew and Mark. John has three words. Jesus, and those are partly, at least, other directed words. Jesus is concerned about his mother and the disciple and care for each other. And then in John, I thirst. And then the inn is finished. Those three are in John. So there's three words in Luke's gospel. The first word is the Father, forgive them, the soldiers. So again, another directness. Even the people that are bringing all this on him, you have the other directness there. Father, forgive them. Okay. And okay. And I... we'll still get this up here. At the top, before we get to the second word, I'm going to have to move this up. But at the top here, it's interesting, in Mark's gospel, again, with the people, I just want to mention this part. The people who are coming are saying words of derision. They're deriding Jesus on the cross. Those people are passing by, and the priest and all. It's all a negative kind of thing.
And Luke omits the part, people are just simply watching. They're learning from this kind of thing. So the people or the crowds are there in a more positive kind of way. So that's reinforced by that comment. And then we get to the next word of the cross, is the conversation with the thief on the cross. So again, another directed kind of thing. First one is to the soldiers. Second one is somebody who would be rejected by society. And you have this conversation among the two thieves with Jesus. And the one says, Jesus, remember me when you come into the kingdom. And then Jesus says, truly, today you'll be with me in paradise. And then finally, the last word, number three, is at the death of Jesus, Father, into your hands I commit my spirit. And he breathes his last. And then, of course, the reaction is, well, you don't have anything about the curtain here. That's part over here. But then the centurion reacts, and this is truly the Son of God, or this man was innocent. And then notice you have this here at the end, another reference to the crowds. And they've been moved by the whole experience too. The crowd, multitudes who were assembled, saw what had taken place, and they returned home beating their breasts. So this, they had learned from this particular episode. Jesus on the cross. It had been a kind of a teachable kind of moment there. So you have that different emphasis there. Now, the last thing I want to do here, just kind of get you thinking. The beginning, we started off with the temptation, the last temptation. And so I said, remember how Luke ordered the three temptations. We have bread first, then what do we have? Then the kingdom, and then the throwing yourself down from here. Okay, now I've never looked at this, and I don't know, so, and I haven't read about this anywhere else, but when I started looking at this with different eyes, as this is the last temptation, you have the three temptations at the beginning, you have the three words of the cross. Is there any kind of correlation? And the last one is, Father, into your hands I commit my spirit. Throw yourself down from here. The angels will take charge of you as you follow on your path. And Jesus has followed on his path, and he's entrusted himself to the hands of God and the angels. So in a sense, that's, you know, allowing himself to die in this way is a way of committing himself to God. And really fitting into Psalm 91. So I think there's a parallel to that. Would you, that's an easy one to deal with. Would you see a connection there with those?
Yeah.
In the order. Okay. So we'll back up. The second one, what was the second temptation? Satan chose Jesus, all the kingdoms of the world. And here, the interesting thing is what the thief says, remember me when you come into your kingdom. And Jesus says, you know, truly I say to you, you will be with me in paradise. And I said to you, that's the only time I think paradise is ever mentioned in the Gospels. And I mean, one thing is paradise and kingdom, and what kind of kingdom is it? And that was part of the temptation story, you know, the kingdoms of this world into your kingdom and the paradise. And of course, paradise was a Persian word. It was borrowed. And it referred to the great wilderness areas. There, I mean, they were filled with vegetation, and the Persian rulers would often go hunting in those areas. So it was a very plush kind of wilderness area. I mean, more of a Holden kind of wilderness kind of area. And but the thing is, you know, remember the kingdom. So is there a connection between that one and the second temptation? Maybe. The first one is the most difficult, and I don't know. I'm not sure what to make of it. The first one is the Father, forgive them. But all this is a stretch. When you read something with different eyes, and is this the last temptation? And I hate, you know, how much you're reading into the text. But the first one is the Father, forgive them, for they know not what they do. And of course, it's you know, turn the stones into bread. But the response is, should not live by bread alone, but by the words that come from God's mouth. And what are the words? What shall you live by? The way of forgiveness. And what strikes me about that is where Luke puts this in is right before the soldiers divide up his garments, where it's placed there. I mean, bread symbolizes more than just food. In a way, bread is what you need for life, right? Anything, the sustenance you need, what you need for daily living. And the journey, what we saw yesterday, is talking about those possessions and what you do with those. And here, the last possessions that Jesus has have been taken over by the soldiers. And at that moment, it's the word is a word of forgiveness kind of thing. So I don't know if that one fits with number three, but if you think about that all the rest of the day, is, you know, are those three parallel in the first three? It's new to me, and I'm still, sometimes I say yeah, and sometimes I wonder. Yeah, Bill.
I forget which book it was, but in one of Henry Nouwen's books, he talks about the three temptations, and he says that the first temptation, as he interprets it, is the temptation to be relevant.
Oh.
And as opposed to the call to be transcendent. Okay. And, you know, so how do we live in that tension? And I think Jesus says they don't have the eyes to see the transcendent here. They're just trying to be relevant in Roman culture. They're trying to be relevant as it relates to Jewish culture. And, you know, so that's a wonderful insight you're sharing with us.
So that forgiveness is the word that's the one.
I didn't get in on the whole study, but I heard you saying that Jesus is other directed throughout Luke. It strikes me then that one of the words from the cross, the concern for his mother, is not the one of them mentioned.
Yeah.
Because that's his concern for the other two.
Yeah. But remember, Luke changed, or I don't know if Luke changed from Matthew, changed, but Luke's order of the temptation stories is different from Matthew's. And that order, I think, might fit this order here. So this is the last temptation. And again, the bottom line there, at the end, and the crowds were there, learning. And so this is how Jesus handled things. Now, what are we going to learn from this, and what are we going to do with this? But you know, having the people there, the emphasis on that, and you know, we are the people who are watching. So taking that into our own. So, all right. Okay. Tomorrow we'll move to resurrection, if we do get a 40. That's specific. I'm not going to read that in the text. So Jesus appeared to the disciples over a period of 40 days. So that's what we're going to learn. Okay, thanks for coming. Enjoy the day.